Guys, how you doing? Good to see you guys. Beautiful day. And you chose to be here tonight at the end of it, so that's a cool way to end a beautiful day. Well, I want to dive right into some scripture. Will you, if you got a Bible, turn to Matthew 5. We're going to be in verses 33 through 37. And if you don't have one, that's okay. You can take one of ours if you don't own one. They're back in the back. Or you can follow along on the screen behind me. Let me read that for us. Verse 33 of Matthew 5 says this. Jesus is speaking. He says, "You have also heard that our ancestors were told, 'You must not break your vows. You must carry out the vows that you make to the Lord.' But I say, do not make any vows. Do not say, 'By heaven,' because heaven is God's throne. And do not say, 'By the earth,' because the earth is his footstool. And do not say, 'By Jerusalem,' for Jerusalem is the city of the great king. Do not even say, 'By my head,' for you can't turn one hair white or black. Just say a simple 'Yes, I will,' 'No, I won't.' Anything beyond this is from the evil one." Have you ever had to make a public vow? Have you ever, had to make a promise in front of a lot of people? And if you've ever stood in front of an altar and taking somebody's hand in your hand and said that you promise to have and to hold in sickness and in health, to death do us part. That's a public vow you've made. Or maybe it was signing a promissory note, so that you could get the keys to your new home or your new car. That's a public record, a public promise that you have made. I had to take an oath on the Bible once. Anybody else ever have to do that in court? I've had to do that before. It happened several years ago. There was a car accident right in front of my house. It was early one morning. I heard a screech, a bang. My wife and I kind of jumped up from our bed, ran to the window, and there in the street was a car with its airbags deployed and two guys getting out of it. They're kind of shaking the dust off of themselves. My wife was quick on the draw. She got the phone out and started calling 911. And I just kind of stood there just watching the whole thing like, this is crazy, right out in front of our house, right on the street. And believe it or not, the two young men got out of the car, dusted themselves off, and while my wife is on the phone with the 911 operator, they took off and turned into track stars. running down the street. So my wife runs down the stairs of our house, out into the street, in her pajamas, and she's giving a play-by-play commentary to the 911 operator. They're going down Cedar Drive. They're getting ready to take a left on. They're taking a left on Cabarrus. One of them's taking a right. It was crazy. And sure enough, the police came, the tow truck came. Big response. I gave a statement to the officer because I had been watching them the longest while my wife ran down the stairs. Had to sign the statement, that this is what I saw, this is what I said. I got a call later from a police officer. He said, so tell me what you saw. Tell me what happened. And I had to give my statement again over the phone. Sure enough, that's how I found myself about 2 months later, sitting in a courtroom, awaiting the court docket to, get to my case. And witnessed someone commit a crime. And now it was like my turn to play a part in the legal process. And I was willing to do that. It was kind of my civic duty. And so I stood when the judge entered the courtroom, and I watched the prosecutor and the defense attorneys as they kind of rifled through papers, and I watched the proceedings unfold. It's kind of like being on your own episode of L.A. Law or, Law and Order or something. I don't know. L.A. Law, that's an old one. Wow. Where did that come from? I don't know. And so it was very much something that was just happening in front of me until they called my name. And now all of a sudden it seems very real and it's a very intense experience. And I began to feel very intimidated. And I walked to the front of the courtroom and the court officer put a Bible out in front of me and made me swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It's no joke. They make you do the whole thing. And I said I would. And then I glanced at the defendant, and here's the scary part, the crazy part. I didn't know for sure if I recognized that guy. I didn't know if that was him. I mean, it was kind of daybreak. It was at night. He was a ways away, and it all happened so fast. I mean, 30 seconds, maybe a minute. And now I was sitting in court, sitting in a chair opposite a man whose destiny, to some extent, was in my hands. And I was uncertain. I answered all the questions as truthfully as I could. What I had seen, whether or not the defendant looked like the driver of the vehicle, how far away I was from the scene of the crime, you know, what time it was, so on and so forth. And I wanted to do what was right. But when the moment was upon me, I was forced to reckon with the implications of my words. Today, we're in the sixth week of a series that we're calling simply The Sermon. We've been progressing through the three chapters in Matthew's account of Jesus' life, it's chapters 5, 6, and 7, that make up the Sermon on the Mount. Very familiar title, even if you're unfamiliar with the actual words inside. And we've been discovering over the course of these weeks, and we'll continue to discover, the answers to some of life's big questions. What does it look like to be a follower of Jesus in the 21st century? What would it look like to reflect the light of Jesus in our lives as neighbors and friends and spouses and parents? You know, what would it look like if we began to resemble what Jesus is teaching us to be like and what he embodied himself? And today, you know, we just read this text, and he's dealing in this text with a commandment on lying. He's going to talk to us about integrity and truth and honesty. And, you know, 2 weeks ago, we kind of jumped off the Sermon on the Mount thing last week, but 2 weeks ago we were talking about sexuality, and it was riveting stuff. I mean, everybody's eyes are all locked in on Jed and that. So I don't know if I can captivate you in the same way with honesty and integrity and character, but I hope that I can, because it is every bit as challenging a topic for me, and I can only imagine for you too. So let's take a close look at these verses. Jesus is dealing in the passage with something that's very specific. It's almost like a type of case law. It's kind of like the law around the law. It was being put into practice in Israel during his day. And this particular emphasis that he's you know, kind of speaking to, the people would have been very familiar with this law. And it was all around the rule about lying. Don't lie is one of the Ten Commandments. That's pretty cut and dried. But these kind of rules that Jesus is alluding to, these aren't so cut and dried. They're a little bit, squishy. And so the law that had developed around the commandments looked like this. Here's what they look like. If you lie, the seriousness of the lie depends upon the nature of the vow that you have taken. You see, the people would make promises and they'd make vows and they would swear on something. And the closer that something they swore on was to the name of the Lord or to the center of the temple, the more serious the lie was. You following me? So if they said, the courtyard, I swear by the courtyard in the temple. Well, that's pretty close to the inner Holy of Holies, but it's not as close as it would be if I said I'm swearing by the gold on the altar in the temple. And so that was the degree to which you were being honest, the degree to which you were trying to commit yourself to a promise. And the closer that thing was, the more serious it was. The reason for this was the temple of the Lord was the place that they knew God's name dwelled. And so if you swore by the name of God, or if you swore by the temple, you were actually swearing by or invoking the personal presence of God for your vow. So it was serious business. You'd say, I'm going to tell the truth. I'm going to stick to my vow. And the way that I can assure you that I will is because I'm swearing on the presence of God. Now, the law developed around this and said that if you didn't really do it just so, then the lie wasn't so serious. Okay, there was all kinds of ways to kind of subvert the rules a little bit. And Jesus is dealing with these kind of laws of practice, right? Not just here, but elsewhere. There's a place in Matthew 23, which is later in this same gospel. And Jesus is talking to the leaders, the teachers of the law, and he says, you say that it means nothing to swear by God's temple, but that it's binding to swear by the gold in the temple. Blind fools. Which is more important, the gold in the temple that makes the gold, or that which makes the gold sacred? Actually, I messed it up. The gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred. Verse 18, and you say that to swear by the altar is not binding, but to swear by the gifts on the altar is binding. I mean, can you see how complicated they're trying to make this? I mean, how they're giving themselves as much wiggle room to get out of something as they can? Verse 19, Jesus says, how blind? For which is more important, the gift on the altar or the altar that makes the gift sacred? When you swear by the altar, you're swearing by it and everything on it. And when you swear by the temple, you're swearing by it and by God who lives in it. And when you swear by heaven, you're swearing by the throne of God and by God who sits on the throne. Okay. This is not necessarily familiar stuff to us. We don't have this kind of case law that surrounds the way that we choose to live and move and breathe. And so why does this have any significance for us today? Why would Jesus try to dismantle these arguments? What was he trying to tell us all these years later? What can we learn? Well, what Jesus is saying in these passages is that there isn't a time when you are outside the presence of God. He is always present. God is always with you. He is the creator and sustainer and owner of everything. He's everywhere. And therefore, you're always present to him. There isn't a time when you can kind of say, well, I didn't say it just so. Because he's there. He knows. And if we understood that, if we were able to have the presence of mind in the way that we live on a daily basis, to acknowledge that he is with us at all times, think about the degree to which that would shape who we are. Think about the kind of integrity that we would probably have compared to what we currently have. And here's my question for us today. Is that actually true? You know, if we could fully acknowledge the presence of God with us, would it actually make us people of integrity? See, here's where I want to press into some of the underlying things that Jesus is trying to get to when he's talking through this sermon, okay? And if you've been with us through the course of this series, then you've heard us explain this concept before. Jed's been very clear each week. Jesus is teaching us that if we're trying to earn God's favor by the way that we behave, we're going to follow all the rules to the nth degree, then we're playing a fool's game. It's a fool's game. Our personal attempts at right living are never going to measure up. And if we're operating under the assumption that when we have, you know, lived a good life and we've played by the rules, that God will have to hear our prayers and he'll have to accept us. If that's kind of our mode of operating, that we believe that we're just going to earn God's favor by doing the things that we're supposed to do, then we need to understand that his standards vastly surpass ours. And Jesus is, in this text, he's making this point again by teaching us about the weight of our words. Think of it this way, okay? If you're trying to merit God's acceptance of you through good behavior, then the thought that he is always watching you is going to become a crushing weight. It's going to be a burden on your shoulders because there's no way that you can be perfect. It's just not going to, it demands perfection. It reminds me of what I just read this week. Did you read the article this week about the realtor who is selling a house for a client who had moved out of his house but had left his house staged to sell? And the realtor, with the client, you know, out of state and out of the picture, had been using that home to have an affair. But what he didn't know was the owner of the home had placed motion-sensitive cameras all throughout the house. And he was watching online just to keep track of his house, make sure it was safe and secure. And he saw this whole thing transpire. And the realtor lost his job. And the woman he was having the affair with lost her job. They're both realtors. and they both are married. And I can only imagine that if they would have known somebody was watching all the time, and that somehow their spouses and their employers were going to find out, they were going to have a window into what was going on, they would have behaved differently, right? Isn't that what we think, right? I mean, think about your own life, right? If you knew that somebody was watching, wouldn't you think that you'd behave differently? But the reality is that we just don't have it in us to be that perfect. We make mistakes. And so if you believe the gospel, there's something that's very freeing about this, because if you're living under a standard that says, I have to comply to the law to merit God's favor, what happens when you mess up the first time? You know, do you get a second try? I mean, do you get a third try? I mean, it's just got to be a crushing weight to live under. But if you live under the gospel of grace, if you believe that you're saved by a radical grace, then it's not what we do, but what Jesus has done that gives us hope. And now, are you going to live in fear of God? Well, yes, but it's not a fear of condemnation or punishment, or that he's going to find out and he's going to zing you for it. Instead, it's a fear of causing him pain. He's loved us so significantly. He's loved us in spite of ourselves. We want to bring him joy. The law of God is a wonderful thing for us now, because it's a way for me to avoid causing him pain. Now, because of the law, I can know what will bring him joy. And I want to do that in response to what he's done for me. If you believe the gospel, the idea of Jesus always being with you is life-giving. Do you know why? Do you understand the difference? See, when someone is present with you whom you love, it certainly carries with it a measure of accountability. It does. We don't want to disappoint them. It does matter how we live. But if we're in the presence of someone we love, it fills our lives with joy and with comfort. And that's the reason why David can say in Psalm 16:8, and I love this verse. Psalm 16:8 says, David speaking says, I have set the Lord ever before me. Because he's at my right hand, I will never be shaken. What does David mean when he says that he set the Lord ever before me? You know, a vow recognizes the presence of God. It doesn't create it. It simply recognizes that God is with us. And David was not saying, I'm bringing God into a position in my life. Because God's already with us. You know, we don't bring him anywhere. He's just there. What he's actually saying is, I recognize that God is with me. I acknowledge it. And because he's with me, I'm never going to be shaken. What does that mean? It means he doesn't do anything that later on he'd be ashamed of, because God is present. And at the same time, he can be bold and courageous because he knows that the one who loves him is right there. Okay. Jesus is telling us in this text, I think, that that's the secret to integrity. It's what will motivate us to be the same person everywhere that we go. It's what's going to motivate us to be the same person in private that we are in public, because we're always in the presence of God. And he's not a God that's just waiting for us to screw up so he can just... No. He's a God that loves us with such affection that he'd sacrifice his son on our behalf. And that changes everything. Now, here's the question, and it's the hard part. Just because we know that God is with us, practically speaking, how do we begin to live out integrity? How do we become people who put the principle into practice? You know, how do we learn to behave like people with integrity? That's a question for us. And for this, I want us to look at the last verse of our text today. It's verse 37. In this verse, as simple as it is, Jesus tells something to us about integrity, and really it's about honesty in particular. He says, simply let your yes be yes, or your no be no. And that's the way I grew up. learning it, right? Let your yes be yes, let your no be. In our text today, it's, say, yes, I will, or no, I won't. And what does that mean? What Jesus is saying is, if you say yes to something, let it really be yes. Don't say yes over here when it would be no over here. Don't say yes over here, but live like it's no over here. If it's yes, it's really yes. If it's no, let it really be no. And I realize that's still a little vague, so I want to give you a couple questions. You might want to write them down. I don't know. It's something that you can kind of have just as a little bit of a litmus test for this. Here are some integrity questions for us to ask ourselves, okay? First one, do you say one thing but do another? Parents? No, I'm just kidding. The only reason I say it is because I've got two girls at home and they're very good at pointing out when I do. Second one, okay? Do you say you believe one thing, but really you're thinking another? Are you one way in public, but another in private? There's two yous walking around. Are you one way over here when you're in this environment, but you're another way when you're in this environment? For instance, okay, you know, Red Sox fans, when you're down on Yawkey Way and you've got your baseball cap on, your regalia, and your, you know, somebody says, you know, go Red Sox, you're like, yeah, go Sox! And then you happen to be on a business trip in New York City. You kind of put that in the, you know, the luggage rack. You put the other stuff away, and when somebody says, hey, how do you think about them Yankees? Well, yeah, nice pinstripes. Yeah, pretty cool. You know, it's a question for us. Are we one way in one environment and another way in another environment? Are you something different where you work than you are when you're here in this place? Are you different online than what you are in reality? Are you a snarling lion online and a wimpy little lamb in reality? You know, are you a Reddit troll? I'm going to keep pressing us on this. We have the technology to brand ourselves and present ourselves with to others the way that we want to be seen. And it's the reason why today people, I think, have fewer qualms about padding resumes, adding facts to bios, falsifying academic research, misrepresenting facts in doing journalism, plagiarism. I mean, people write books and claim it's a memoir only to find later that the thing is just riddled with inaccuracies and stretching of the truth in dramatic ways. And that's because we are in a society and a culture that says that we can kind of reinterpret who we are online and in other contexts. I love C.S. Lewis. Sometimes he's hard for me to read. I have to read him really slow, like a sentence at a time. In this book, The Abolition of Man, he said this, and this is a one that I had to read a couple times. He says, we clamor for qualities that we are rendering impossible. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings go be fruitful. And what he means is this. We tell everyone that truth is just a relative thing. It floats. There's no truth. There's, you know, right and wrong are situational based on the context. And then we're just shocked when people cheat, when people take advantage of the rules and they flaunt the way that it's supposed to be. Here's the thing. If you're not a person of integrity, then every act that lacks integrity has a consequence. It really does. Right? And I've got four that come to mind. Four massive problems that happen when we lack integrity. You want to hear what they are? When we have a lack of integrity, when we are not truthful, it destroys relationships and community. It destroys our identity, who we are. It destroys other people's dignity. And it puts us on a collision course with reality. Because at some point, the truth will out, right? Every time you lack integrity, it destroys community. Let me explain what that means. One scholar put it like this. Imagine a society in which no one trusted anyone to keep a promise, in which every leader was expected to lie as a matter of course, in which every teacher was suspected as an academic cheat, and every preacher a moral fraud, in which all contracts were never expected to be honored, no partner could bank on the loyalty of another, no one would make decisions of assurance on having the facts in hand. Life would be brutalized. We'd go from a community to a jungle. And it's true. Every single time we lack integrity, we're eating away at the fabric of community. Because there are places in the world today that are like that. There have been places in the world like that in the past, and they're the most miserable places in the world to live. Nobody would want to live there in that kind of environment. So every time we do something that lacks integrity, it eats away at community, but it also tears away at who we are as people. It tears away at our identity. Who are you? That's a hard question to ask. I was in my small group this week, and I asked the group, okay, if you were to look in a mirror right now, and you were to describe the person that you see, not the physical traits or characteristics, but who's in there, what would you say? Who are you when you look at yourself in the mirror? How would you describe that to somebody? The only way to answer that is to find something that's always true of you. I mean, because we have many roles, we wear many hats, but to ask that question, who are you? The only answer is something that you do or something about you or something you believe, something that you are that always stays the same. There's this play, it's written by a man named Robert Bolt, A Man for All Seasons. He was writing about Sir Thomas More, who's getting ready to be executed in the play because he refused to take back certain statements that he had made. And he was waiting in prison when his daughter Meg comes to visit him, and he pleads, and she's pleading with him to lie about the statements, say that he doesn't believe those things anymore, just to save his life. And there's this famous passage in the play where he looks at her and he says, "When a man takes an oath, Meg, he's holding himself in his hands like water. And if he opens his fingers, then he needn't hope to ever find himself again." Do you hear what he's saying? When I've sat down with people who have blown up their lives because they lied, because they had an affair, because they've been covering up and lying about addiction for years, it's not just that they feel guilty. They don't just feel bad about all the ruptured relationships. So often, I hear them say something akin to this: "I just don't know who I am anymore." Why is that? Because when we behave in every situation in a way that is most advantageous to us, if it means that we lie or cheat or break promises, if we always do what is most beneficial to us, then in the end, there is no us left. There's no me left anymore. I've just done whatever I could, spread myself so thin across so many different arenas that I don't have an identity anymore. In the end, there's no me. Integrity. It's essential in community. It's essential to who we are. And when you lack integrity, it violates the dignity of other people. Just walks all over them. I mean, what is so wrong about a lie? Maybe you're thinking this right now. What's so wrong about a little lie? Well, when we lie to someone, we're exploiting that person. We're not allowing them to see reality. We're putting them at a disadvantage. We're using them in a way, turning them into an instrument to be used for our purpose. We're withholding from them the grasp on reality that they need to have just simply as a human being. And we're violating their dignity. When we lie, we treat others as children at best and as objects at worst. In her book, Smoke on the Mountain, Joy Davidman wrote that there are lies of gossip that make haters out of us. There are lies of advertising that make money out of us. There are lies of politicians that make power out of us. In other words, lies turn us from human subjects into objects to be used. Every lie demeans. It destroys the dignity of the person you're speaking to. And then this fourth thing. When we have a lack of integrity, it puts us on a collision course with reality because the truth is going to come out. There is a real world out there, and we can kind of fabricate all we want, but there is reality, and we're going to come face to face with that reality eventually, which is why people say honesty is the best policy, because it's going to catch up to you if you lie. The disconnect between who we say we are and who we really are eventually catches up. And here's the thing. Okay, integrity is more than just telling the truth. It's more than that. It's being the same in every area of life. It's wholeness. But in particular, it is the truthfulness of things, okay? Not deceiving other people. When Jesus says, don't make any vows, you might think that what he means is that we can't take an oath. You know, me putting my hand on the Bible, that should I not have done that? You know, should we not have stood up in front of the people at our wedding and made those promises to our spouses? No, I don't think that that's what Jesus means here. If it was, it wouldn't make much sense because the Bible is filled with covenants and promises. I mean, Jesus takes an oath. Paul takes oaths. God has taken oaths. See, they've made vows and commitments. So that's probably not what Jesus is saying. And so instead, I want us to look at what he's saying over it. What is he saying? Well, he says, do not make any vows. Simply say, yes, I will, or no, I won't. And here's what I think he means, okay? If someone else wants you to make a promise because it will assure them, you know, give them some kind of assurance about something, that's fine. But when it comes to you, there can be no levels of truthfulness in our life. No degrees of, I'm going to be more truthful in these situations and less truthful in these situations. We should simply be able to say, yes, I will, or no, I won't. When it comes to other people interacting with us, if they need a promissory note to be signed, okay, that's fine. But as far as it goes by me, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to live with integrity. We can never think that we're, you know, if we swear on something, then that means we're bound to it. But if we don't, well, then we don't have to follow through. No, what Jesus is saying is, if we're his people, if we've chosen to be one of his followers, then we are always under oath. Everything that we say should be as truthful as if we're standing in a courtroom swearing with our hand on a Bible. There's this place in Matthew 12, I hate this text, where it says, we'll be judged for every idle word. Seriously? Every idle word? You know what the word idle means? It means offhanded comments. I am the king of offhanded comments. I am in big trouble. There are no levels to truthfulness. That's what Jesus is saying. If others want us to make a promise of assurance, well, okay, but as far as it goes by me, I'm going to make my yes, yes, and my no, no. Or let me put it like this. Can I ask you, if you knew that everything that you said tomorrow was going to be videoed and broadcast, just like that poor realtor, you know, if it was going to happen to you tomorrow, would it make any difference in the way that you choose to speak? Would what you say to others, how you presented yourself, if it was all out there for somebody else to hear, would that make a difference in how you'd speak? I think we would all say yes. It would make a big difference. It would make a difference for me. And you know what that means? It means that we're all foolish. It does. Me included. If we know that God is with us, then how can we not be people of integrity? A yes, I will, or a no, I won't is what's required. Now, it's not enough for me to just say this. I know that. You know, this is how we should live, so go out and try harder. That would be ridiculous. We have to ask ourselves this question. Why are we not so good at this? Why am I so bad at this? Why I get angry with myself at being duplicitous? You know, I'm one way over here, I'm one way over here. Well, I believe that the problem and the solution are in our text. And it's not overtly stated, but listen to Jesus' words. He says, you have also heard that our ancestors were told, you must not break your vows. You must carry out the vows you make to the Lord. And that little phrase, carry out, it's an interesting word in the Greek. In the original Greek, it means literally to pay. Pay your vows. And it's a strange word choice, but it's a significant one. Especially when Jesus is communicating that everything we say is like a vow. What he's saying is this: truth costs. And you know this is true. I do too. Because telling the truth comes with a cost. We have to pay that price sometimes. So often the reason we don't tell the truth, not always, but oftentimes, it's because we know it's going to cost us something. If we tell the truth, we're going to have to pay the price for it. Now, this depends on who you are, how that price is paid, I think. For instance, the way I'm wired up, and some of us in the room, we desire people's approval. Our self-esteem is based on people liking us. That's a very intrinsic part of who we are. So we want people to be pleased with us. We want their approval. And sometimes we're going to realize that if we tell the truth, that it might make somebody angry. If I tell the truth, he's going to be so mad at me, or she's going to be so upset when she hears what I have to say. And so we fudge, or we spin, or we exaggerate, or we misdirect, and we lie about it. Why? We're unwilling to pay the price. Some of us are not approval people in the room. Some of us are control people. We need to keep control of things. Sometimes a person who likes to be in control will realize, if I tell the truth, I'm going to be at a disadvantage. And here's the thing, approval people, we don't mind being at a disadvantage so long as people like us. But somebody who is wired up to be in control or to want to control, well, they could care less if somebody likes them so long as they're in control. In both cases, in different situations, certain truth-telling comes with a terrible price, doesn't it? Because it rattles what makes us secure in the world. It rattles our identities. I won't be in control because I can't control this thing if I am honest. Or I won't be accepted because if I'm honest, that person, that might break our relationship. How are we going to get to the place where we're not scared, we're not rattled, we're secure enough to always pay the price to tell the truth? In John 18, Jesus is on trial before the teachers of the law, the Sanhedrin, and they hit him across the face. And when they hit him, Jesus looks at those guys and he says, "You hit me because I told you the truth." And then later in the same chapter, when he's before Pilate, Jesus says, "I'm being sentenced because I'm telling the truth." Pilate says, "What is truth?" And what do we learn from those two exchanges? Well, I think we learn this. Jesus, when he went to the cross, was paying the price for telling the truth. But he wasn't just paying the price for his own honesty. He was paying the price for our dishonesty. We don't tell the truth. We deserve a penalty because we have done this before God. Jesus has taken the penalty on himself. He's paid the price for our lack of honesty. Why wouldn't those moralistic Pharisees, why couldn't they stand what Jesus was telling them? Why did they hit him across the face? Well, it's because their self-image was that they were good people. And if the basis of your life is that you're a good person and someone comes along and shows you something that destroys or hurts that, then it's going to be very difficult to pay the price to admit that. We don't like the truth at times because we feel stripped naked by it. Well, Jesus was stripped naked. He allowed himself to be vulnerable for our sake so that we could instead be clothed in his righteousness. And here's the new self-image that you have when you choose to trust in Christ as your Savior. Jesus died on a cross, and that means God looked into your life, and he looked into your heart, and he saw the worst that you had to offer, and he saw everything about you, and he loved you anyway. And now we can have the security and strength to handle the truth. If we believe the good news, we're clothed with Christ and he loves us no matter what, which gives us the strength to handle when somebody doesn't like us. You know, I love people's approval, but if somebody doesn't like me, I can handle it. And so if you're wired up to love control and you have to tell the truth and it means you might not be in control anymore, well, you can handle it. Because you're secure in him. Jesus paid the price by telling the truth. And he paid the price for our lack of honesty too. We're saved because of his integrity. When hell was opening up under his feet, when the nails were about to be hammered in, and it looked like it was going to be terrible, Jesus kept his promise. He was a man of integrity. And that's the reason why you and I can live. When we see him doing this for us, we can have integrity for him because he fortifies us enough to do it with his love. So set the Lord ever before you. If he's at your right hand, you can never be shaken. Let's pray. God, thank you for loving me.